Assalamu alaikum. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala tahirin. I think during the last few nights, the discussions were becoming maybe a bit difficult to follow for some. And so I think we've brought that discussion to an end. Unless I get some feedback and some questions or emails, and then we'll return to it if necessary. But tonight, inshallah, something, a different theme, a bit more easy, inshallah. Since today was the demise anniversary of Lady Khadija, alayhi salam, usually this part of the holy month and during Fatimiyya period, I speak about certain issues in relation to women. Tonight, inshallah, I want to speak about marriage and a certain aspect of marriage, and this may have some relevance on a community level at least. So when your children want to marry, some themes to bear in mind, inshallah. In the Holy Quran, in relation to women and in relation to marriage, there are certain laws and principles that can be extrapolated from the Quran in relation to the status of the woman and in relation to the philosophy of marriage. One of those laws can be entitled the law of uniformity, which means that be you male or female, creation-wise, you're equal. And there are many verses in the Quran which highlight this, and I'll just mention one or two of them, but it's not necessary for me to go through them all, but there are at least 20 verses. But in these 20 or even more verses, that which one extrapolates is that whether you're male or female, creation-wise, you're equal. And no one is superior to the other by nature, by creation. For example, chapter 95, verse 4. لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ. We've created insan. We've created insan. Now, insan includes male and female. In the best of forms. This form need not be physical, because then the verse continues, ثُمَّ رَدَدْنَاهُ أَسْفَلَ صَفِينَ. Then we return them to the lowest level. This is a spiritual level, it's the fitra. The fitra and fitra-wise, creation-wise, they're equal, be you male or female. Or verses which say, وَلَغَدْ, chapter 17, verse 17, وَلَغَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ. We dignified the children of Adam. When you say children of Adam, you mean it covers the male children and the female. She's always both. It's insan, bani adam. Be you male or female, you both possess dignity. You both are equal creation-wise, form-wise. And then there was the verse, chapter 4, verse 1, that we discussed. خَلَقَكُم مِّن نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ. The verse starts, يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ, O people, see, be you male or female. And many other verses that I don't want to go through all of it. All I want to say is this is the law of uniformity. Uniform, be you male or female, you're uniform creation-wise, form-wise, fitra-wise, substance-wise, essence-wise, equal. Now, if we encounter traditions which say women are deficient in aql or in other things, that goes against the logic of the Quran. But instead of saying those traditions are not authentic, rather you have to say those traditions are specific to a particular context where a particular woman or women did a particular action which led to that deficiency. Because actions, one can be superior to another by means of their actions, not by means of their race, creation, fitra, whatever. But in relation to one's actions, the concept of superiority is valid. Now, a woman or women may have done something wrong, and then the tradition came that women are deficient. That has to be explained in this way. It has to be particularized. Otherwise, the logic of the Qur'an, fitra-wise, they're equal. Creation-wise, they're equal. Now, if they sin or do bad things, that's another issue. Or some traditions say that don't consult with women. You see? And that goes against the logic of the Qur'an again. The problem with ahadith is that if you don't go through all of them, and you only take some of them, and you're oblivious to the other ahadith, you'll never get a whole picture of what Islam is prescribing. Don't consult with women. Actually, in the traditions, it comes in a particular context where the woman wants to go and do something haram at a party. The man goes to the imam, says, "Shall I discuss it with my wife? And maybe we can come to an agreement with one another for her to go." The imam said, "No, don't consult with her in these issues. With haram things, there's no room for sharing the same platform with them." But the same applies to men too. If men sin or do bad actions, the same rule applies to women. They shouldn't consult with the man. They shouldn't compromise in relation to the haram, in relation to bad actions. It doesn't matter whether you're male or female. And actually, traditions from Imam Baqir alayhi salam, where the man is sinning and doing wrong, the imam is saying that man is deficient because of a result of their actions. The man is deficient, aql-wise. But that's because of a particular context. So these things, that's the law of uniformity. These laws are important because then you get a general, universal principle from the Qur'an, then the traditions can be interpreted accordingly. There's another law, it's the law of pairs. Pairing. Chapter 51, verse 49. وَمِنْ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ خَلَقْنَا زَوْجَيْنِ. And from everything, we created pairs. It's a general principle in the Qur'an. Whatever is a thing, that thing is created in pairs. In chapter 36, verse 36, سُبْحَانَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْأَزْوَاجَ كُلَّهَا مِمَّا تُنْبِتُ الْأَرْضُ وَمِنْ أَنْفُسِهِمْ وَمِمَّا لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. That immaculate be Allah, be He who created pairs, all of them, from the things that grow in earth, from yourselves, people, and from things that you don't have knowledge yet. For example, we have pairs even in bacteria. Now bacteria, they reproduce asexually. They're still in pairs. They call it positive and negative bacteria. And there are many other things too that we don't know of even today. But the law is important, the principle of pairing. So here what is established is for the survival of beings, existing beings. Now, or for the salvation, for the survival. Now that can be a materialistic survival, can be a spiritual survival. But the survival of beings, for them to survive materialistically or spiritually, comparing is essential. Now, in another verse of the Quran, the story of Nabi Nuh, Prophet Noah, alayhi salam, we see how this pairing is essential, both materialistically and also spiritually. In chapter 11, verse 40, it says, "Ihmil fiha min kullin zawjayn ithnayn." Carry in the ark from each one, meaning animals, but also humans, two mates for each kind. So now here, in the story of Noah's ark, both materialistic survival was an issue because mankind had to survive because the rest were going to be annihilated, and also spiritually, the righteous people went on board. And so they went man and woman. They went on board to start new life after the 40 days and nights of flooding. But ihmil fiha min kullin zawjayn ithnayn, two mates from each being. So in short, we see that pairing is significant for man's survival and for the survival of man's objectives and goals. Because man isn't separable from one's aims and objectives and goals. You can't separate them. If man survives, man's goals will survive too. In order for man's objectives and goals to survive, pairing is something very significant here. Right. Now, this question of pairing even enters the fiqhi realm, the letter of the law, especially in the chapter of marriage and who you should marry. This principle of pairing permeates in fiqh, especially in the chapter of marriage. Now, in marriage, the Sharia has a lot of criteria. Some of those criteria are wajib, some are mustahab, some are mubah, some are makruh, some are haram. If this particular criterion is seen in the other party, male or female, it's haram to marry. Sometimes it's wajib to marry. Mostly it's mustahab to marry. Usually that's the case. Marriage is a very emphasized as a mustahab action, but it's one of those emphasized mustahab actions. And sometimes it's a mubah action. Now, there are two criteria which have maybe they rank, I mean, there are many criteria, they're all important. Some are primary, some are secondary. But the secondary ones are important too. I don't want you to misunderstand. But the primary ones, there are two specific ones which are very important in marriage. Now, first of all, this, when I say marriage, I mean the permanent marriage. I don't mean the temporary marriage. That has a different philosophy. And that's why temporary marriages have different criteria. Why are the criteria in permanent marriages different to the criteria in temporary marriages? It's because of the philosophies are different. With permanent marriage, it's a holy endeavor. You want to get closer to Allah. And this is very important. And the criteria for permanent marriages show this. The criteria, like if the other party doesn't do salat, it's better to abandon them. It's not wajib, but it's better to abandon them. Why would they say that? Why does such a criteria not exist for the temporary marriage? So it's something different here. And there are other criteria too. This is a holy endeavor, a permanent marriage. You marry to get closer to Allah. That's the ultimate objective in this marriage. Yes, the materialistic survival too is another objective. But that's much more important. Well, they're both important, because if there are no people, then that spirituality can't be preserved either. But there are two specific criteria that we have to pay attention to. I want to speak about the second one in detail tonight. But let me just mention the first one and quickly pass through that. And that is tattva. That male or your spouse, your future spouse. And you know, spouse in Arabic is zawj. The female spouse is zawj in Arabic. The male spouse, we call it zawj. They're both called zawj. And that's why its plural is azwaj. In Arabic, we don't call the female spouse zawja. They call it zawj. If they would call it zawja, zawjaton, then its plural would have been zawjat. But in the Quran, the plural of zawj is always azwaj. That's just a technical grammatical point. Sorry about that. Anyway, so what is taqwa? Now, taqwa is a very ambiguous term. What do you mean by taqwa? It has a wide range of applications. That which you have to substantiate in an Islamic marriage, this is an Islamic setting now, you as Muslims, you need to establish, it's not wajib, but it's very, very recommended. It's one of those very important primary aims that your spouse pays attention to the halals and the harams of a religious authority. It doesn't matter who the religious authority is, but they don't look at halals and harams how they think is halal, what is halal, what is haram, or they're not even attentive to these matters. If that's the case, be careful. You won't have a successful Islamic marriage. You may have a successful materialistic marriage, but Islamically that marriage won't be successful. And your fate may be compromised. Your aghibat, your fate. But you may have a very successful materialistic marriage. But that's another issue now. So what we mean by taqwa, if the minimum taqwa, is that that person, not that the person never sins, everyone sins. I sin, you sin, it happens. But that person, they pay attention to and are attentive to and treat it very seriously. That there's a religious authority, they give harams and harams, and that is my source of reference in matters of halal and haram. This much has to be substantiated. Now, taqwa has much higher degrees too. But this much is a minimum. So that's taqwa. But the second, and this one I want to open up because it's more ambiguous, is the idea of kufr, equivalence. Your spouse, it's recommended, not wajib, it's recommended, and we'll explain why Islam has recommended such. Try that and make you, and choose a spouse, male or female, whoever you are, who is your equivalent, who is your kuf. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَخَدٍ. Allah has no equivalent. But you choose your equivalent in this pairing process. Now this has to be opened up, inshallah, and I want to do that in the next 10 or 20 minutes. So in marriage, the Sharia prefers that this pair, the newlyweds who are now pairing with one another and they're marrying, the Sharia prefers that they are equivalent to one another. And only then can they truly complement one another. And if they successfully complement one another, they can reach their goals materialistically and spiritually. That's the main formula that the Sharia has, but I want to open this up. So, two equivalent I'll define everything in a minute, but two equivalent spouses, they can successfully complement one another. And by doing so, they can reach their goals and objectives materialistically and spiritually. In relation to animals, when the verse said, carry them in, each type of animal in pairs, here, animals, like whatever the animal is, like penguins, camels, parrots, whatever, the pair that exists in animals, they're very equivalent to one another. Animals are almost the same, they think the same, they act the same. The diversity isn't that much in between themselves. In humans, the diversity does expand exponentially. And so equivalency is difficult to find in humans when you compare it with animals. Every pair of animals, pair of penguins, camels, or whatever, yeah, you see that they're equivalent to one another. We haven't defined what equivalent means, but I'll come to that. But the nature, at least, is the same. And that's why really, you know, divorce and that kind of thing in animals is not even an issue. Not that they can divorce one another, or they don't even have the concept of marriage as we know it. The concept of divorce as we know it doesn't even exist there. But in that verse, equivalency between animals can be observed. With humans, though, the gap, the diversity in equivalency, it's much wider. The potential for non-equivalency is much greater. And so, the Sharia says, in marriage, in your pairing, you find your equivalent. If you do, you will maximize that inner potential. That journey to Allah, that proximity to Allah and other things, it will be maximized. The more equivalent you are with one another, it will facilitate you acquiring those ultimate objectives. The less equivalent you are, the more difficult it will be. Okay, now, what is this equivalence that man and woman should be looking for? Here, the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt specify equivalence as a criterion. They do that, but they don't tell us what equivalence means. And whenever the Sharia, whenever religion, doesn't define something for us, it means we have to refer to all the common lay people of a given society and see how they see equivalence. For example, death, Islam doesn't give a definition for death. So we refer to how people see death. Especially what the people at the time of the Ma'sumin. What was death then amongst the people? Islam never gave a definition, that means they gave the stamp of approval to the Urfi definition of death. There are many things like that in Islam, that when the Sharia doesn't give a definition, it means you refer to Urf. Urf means laity, the common Joe blogs. But the Urf in Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, they're all different. And the Urf there is different to the Urf in America. Here, you people who are under a certain age, your orf is the orf in America. Your parents, grandparents, their orf is abroad. Unless they came here and spent most of their lives here, then their orf becomes here too. So equivalence is an ambiguous term. You have to explain what it means when someone is your equivalent. The Sharia doesn't tell us what it is, so we refer to orf. And now we see, how does Orf, what things do Orf see one as equivalent to another? And I'll go through a list. This list is not exclusive in any way. It's not inclusive in any way. It doesn't cover all the different criteria, but it's some of the major things and parameters that we have to be looking for when we want to find a spouse. The dilemma that many parents maybe here and in the West have, that they came from Pakistan, India, Iran, with a particular oath. They came here and they raised their children in this society, and their children are now, they belong to this orf, and now there's a clash of two orfs. And this leads to problems, because they see orf in one way, the parents, and the child sees it in another way. And this causes problems. The parents here usually have to understand that if the spouse of their daughter or their son, they have the criteria of taqwa and they have equivalence according to their orf, the parents shouldn't insist. They shouldn't push. If they do push, it's problematic. If the parents don't push, as long as the criteria are there, it's better. But if the parents are adamant, some parents, they're not ready to move from their position. It's not a good quality, but they're not ready to move. Here, it's better spiritually for the child to tolerate the parent. Spiritually, it's better. Don't make a big thing out of this. Rely upon Allah and continue. But don't let an argument arise. If the parent isn't willing to be patient and forbear what's happening, the child, for their own spirituality, it's better for them to be patient. And don't think it's the end of the world. There's always plenty of people here. You have to rely upon Allah. Now, what are the parameters of equivalence that we have to be looking for? These are very simple things that we may not take seriously. But now I'm going to go through the list. Now some of these things, I don't want you to think that they're absolutes. Some of them are more important than others. Don't just take one of them and say, well, no, because my, for example, cousin, they had that, but they're living successfully. No, don't enter the particularities. Of course, there will be exceptions. I'm giving you the general formulae, but of course, there's always going to be exceptions. One, and secondly, don't take one of them and ignore the rest. You have to look at all of them together and then finally make a conclusion whether that spouse-to-be is your equivalent or not. But you can't make that decision with one parameter. You have to go through all of them. Okay, let's go through the parameters. So you have to find your equivalent. Equivalent in what? Let's go through the list. One, find your equivalent in age. So if one of them is 20 years old and the other is 40 or 35 or a significant change, a significant gap in age, the Sharia is not necessarily saying don't marry. It's not saying it's haram to marry such a person. It's saying that's one parameter that there's no equivalence, because the gap in age is too much. This can be a source, I stress, emphasize. It's a potential source of tension. It's a potential source of differences in the future. But it may not be. But we have to see that. You may not, people who are in the community and they see these difficulties. Sometimes this is one difficulty. One spouse says, he's so old now, he can't even relate with me. Or the other way around, if it happens. In the beginning, everything may be very sweet, but over a period of time, the difficulties set in. You have to think rationally when you want to find your equivalent. This minimizes the tension. Tensions will always be in a marriage. But this minimizes tensions. And it's one parameter. Maybe someone finds a spouse who is 10 years older than them, 20 years older than them. But with, in relation to the other parameters, they're equivalent to one another. That's okay. Maybe they can sort it out. But when there are many parameters where they're not the equivalent to one another, here they're putting the marriage at risk. So one is an age. One is find your equivalent in beauty. For example, one spouse is beautiful or attractive in the normal sense, but they're stressing that I want to have this spouse who is extremely beautiful. There's no need. Find your equivalent in beauty too. Because that can also be a source for tension in the future when there's a significant gap in beauty. Or for example, someone wants to marry someone but say they're not attractive to me. For example, they themselves are normal in attraction, but the spouse that they want to be, they're a bit below standard according to them. There's going to be a gap in equivalency, in beauty. These things are small things, but believe me, in marriages, when couples come, these are sources of differences. I know, idealistically, it shouldn't arise, but the reality is it does arise. And the Sharia hasn't defined equivalency. It's related to urf. If the spouse-to-be isn't attractive to you, well, be rest assured. Every year as it passes by, nothing's going to change. It may even get worse. But someone may not have this criterion. They have the other criterion, which for them are more important. They can tolerate not having this equivalency. It's the overall package here that at the end, after looking at all the parameters, one makes that final decision. Not, they're not beautiful, forget it. Or the age is high, forget it. No. Another important one is family culture. Find your equivalent in family culture. If you're Iranian, if you're Afghan, if you're Pakistani, if you're whatever, American, it's better for you when you pair up with the same culture. Now, here it's a bit difficult because many of you, when the parents have come, and then you were born and bred here, it's a kind of a dual culture that you're experiencing. In that case, it's better to find one with that dual experience rather than one who is, let's say, purely Afghan. It's better for you to have one who was Afghan, is Afghan, and was brought up here. Because someone who, let's say, is Iranian, Afghan, whatever the culture is, and then someone who was born and bred here, they're Iranian, for example, they're Afghan, whatever, but they were brought up here. Here, that dual culture is significantly different to that single culture of this other spouse. Without a doubt, the cultures differ. In the beginning, it may not be an issue. With time, cultural norms set in. How do you treat my mother? How do you treat my father? When guests come, how do you treat your guests? These are simple things. But certain cultures, the way they treat guests, their mother, their father, is very different to other cultures. If there's not going to be an equivalency in two cultures, not in the beginning maybe, but eventually it may cause problems. It's a source of many problems. We're seeing it in society. Now, however, if we have two people, one is an Iranian who was born and bred in America and an Afghan who was born and bred in America, here the culture is American. They belong to the American culture. Born and bred here, they know the norms here. And that would be less problematic. That's still less problematic. But sometimes no. One is born and bred here, the other isn't, it's going to cause problems. is networking or socializing. Choose your equivalent. Your spouse may be someone who has a very strong degree of networking. They're a socializer. It's important to who they are. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's not haram. But they socialize a lot. Networking is part of who they have become. If you're not a networker and the spouse is, that equivalence is not going to be there. And then later on, this may cause problems. Choose your equivalent in networking. In religion, choose your equivalent. Here, the Sunni and Shia question here. Can you marry, for example, a Shia spouse marry a Sunni spouse? Is it allowed? Well, yes. Most of the marriage have accepted it, as far as I know. Maybe only one who has said no, but all of them have said yes. Okay, that's the letter of the law, you can marry. But it does go against this equivalency. This equivalency is not a haram issue. It's not a wajib or haram issue. This equivalency wants to maximize your inner goals, potential, your journeying to Allah, your proximity with Allah. It wants to minimize the tensions. And let's say one spouse, Shia, marries a Sunni. Now, this is going to cause tensions. You can't deny that. It's going to cause tensions. Eventually, you want to have children. Those children want to be born and bred in a particular way. Right from the very start, you're compromising the faith of the child, to some degree at least. Now, Sunni Shia marriages with your children in America may be becoming a bit common now, compared to when you were in Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, and so on and so forth. But you brought your children here. If there's anyone to start this blame game, it was you who came here, and you gave this life to your children, to be born and bred here. That's one issue. Now your children are here. You have to raise them in a way that from the beginning they choose a girl and Shia partner. But let's say it doesn't happen for whatever reason. Because at the end of the day, they're going to university, workplace, and they're seeing Muslims. There may be a scarcity of Shias. They see a Muslim as a good Muslim, his Sunni is decent, they want to marry. If that happens, first of all, many things happened prior to that which precipitated that action. Not that your child suddenly decided they want to marry. That decision the child made is a result of a set of actions which preceded that over years and years, starting with the parents, starting with coming over here. That action that the child takes to marry, let's say, a Sunni, you don't take it separately. It's a result of many previous actions. So that's one issue. Naturally, of course, it's better to marry your equivalent. It's definitely better. Shia marries a Shia. And if you, from the very beginning, you marry a Sunni, from the very beginning, you're compromising the faith of that future children. Yes, there are exceptions where it happens where the faith is preserved, but mostly it's not preserved. Faith is compromised. Now, in the beginning, man and wife, everything's very sweet, everything's very lovey-dovey, they want to get through this, okay. But after 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, children entering the picture, tensions arise. And then you can't solve these tensions. It becomes almost impossible. Aims, the goals in life, find an equivalent who has similar goals to you. For example, where do you want to live? Place of residence. You'd be surprised, these are very small things, but in the emails, they become big things. find your equivalent in where do they want to live eventually. Sort this out in the beginning, because later on, then one of them says, I want to live there, then you see, a whole can of worms is opened. This can of worms was always shut, because it was never an issue, it was never thought of, never deliberated over, never discussed with one another. But this very issue then becomes a source of differences. Find your equivalent in one's goals in life, such as where one wants to live and so on and so forth, it's important. Find your equivalent in IQ, in knowledge. If you are a normal IQ, don't insist that you want to marry someone with an IQ of 160. It's going to cause difficulties. There may be difficulties in communication somewhere along the line. They may not be able to relate. Man and wife have to relate with one another, speak with one another, discuss with one another about different issues. You imagine someone with IQ of 160, someone with 80, 90, or 100 even. These things are issues that have to be thought of. Find your equivalent in spending and manner of earning. How do you spend? How do they spend? Again, these are very little issues, minor issues. But why do couples come to me with these issues then, if it wasn't to be, you know, significant? And you'd be surprised. For example, in the Lebanese culture, spending money, it has a different understanding. In Iranian culture, they spend money differently. There are different priorities in spending. And this can sometimes cause problems. I don't want to go into minor details of cultures and everything. That may, you know, children, how do they view children? How does your spouse regard the education of the children? How does your spouse, what do they say about the number of children? What do they say about child rearing? What do they say about these things? Are they your equivalent in these matters? If not, later down the line, many years later, the child comes, now differences. One says, well, you're in such a school. You say, it doesn't matter. One says, they have to be read in such a way. The other says, it doesn't matter. When the other says it doesn't matter, it bothers the other one. Well, if it bothers you and this child rearing was a priority, discuss it before your marriage. Find your equivalence in it. And there are many other things, your equivalence in decision-making processes, your equivalence in priorities in life, your equivalence in the approach of argumentation when life's troubles and hurdles approach. Discuss these things before marriage, because after marriage it's all over, you're married. You shouldn't even think of divorce. Divorce is a last resort. But once you're married, this has to work now. So, you have to be rational and think about it before. Have counselling, this community for example, before a couple wants to marry, take them to the local sheikh or whatever, let the local sheikh analyse these two carefully. If there's no local sheikh, you can go to psychologists. They have their own questionnaire system, models, protocols, where they can tell if you're compatible with one another. That kof is a kind of compatibility which wants to be acquired. But they may not look at the Islamic side too much, but we have spiritual and Islamic parameters too. Okay, I'll end there with your permission. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.